I am a big-time fan of Peanuts. I think you can find out a whole lot of life by listening to Lucy. And in one of the more famous Peanuts cartoons, Lucy is philosophizing and Charlie is usually listening. She said, "Charlie Brown, life is like a deck chair. Some place it where to be able to see where they've been. And others put their chair where they can, you know, be in the present." And Charlie sighs and says, "I can't even get mine unfolded." Some days are like that. Some days are difficult. Some seasons of life are difficult. Some are a whole lot more difficult than the trivialness that Charlie Brown's struggling through. But another depiction of that kind of life situation is one of my favorite children's books, The Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. You know this book? If you do not know this book, you must go buy this book and read it to your children tonight. But this exciting book begins by saying, "I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. When I got out of bed this morning, I tripped on the skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink while the water was running. I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At breakfast, Anthony found a Corvette Stingray car kit in his breakfast cereal, and Nick found a junior undercover agent code ring in his breakfast cereal. But in my breakfast cereal, all I found was breakfast cereal. I think I'll move to Australia." In the carpool, Mrs. Gibson let Becky have a seat by the window, and Audrey and Elliot got seats by the window too, and I said I was being scrunched, and I said I was being smushed, and I said if I didn't get a seat by the window, I'm going to be carsick, and nobody even answered. I could tell it was going to be a terrible and horrible and no good, very bad day. And it goes on from there. His teacher liked the picture of the sailboat better than his picture of the invisible castle. At singing time, he sang too loud. At counting time, he skipped 16. He didn't think you need 16 anyway. He says, "I could tell Paul that it was going to be a bad day because Paul said I wasn't his best friend anymore, that Parker was his best friend, and that Albert was his next best friend, and I was only his third best friend." He says, "I hope you sit on a tack, and I hope the next time you get a double-decker strawberry ice cream cone, the ice cream cone falls off and lands in Australia." He says, "There were two cupcakes in Philip's lunch, and Albert got a Hershey bar with almonds, and Philip's mother gave him a piece of jelly roll that had those little coconut sprinkles on it. And guess whose mother forgot to even put in a dessert? It was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day." At the end, he says, "We went to the shoe store to buy some sneakers. Anthony got white ones with blue stripes. Nick got red ones with white stripes. I chose the blue ones with red stripes. But the shoe man said we're all sold out. They made me buy plain old white ones, but they can't make me wear them. We picked up my dad at the office. He said I couldn't play with a coffee machine, but I forgot. He also said, watch out for the books on his desk, and I was as careful as I could be, except for my elbow. My dad said not to have us drop by anymore. It was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. We had lima beans for dinner, and I hate limas. There was kissing on TV, and I hate kissing. My bath was too hot. I got soap in my eyes. My marble went down the drain, and I had to wear my railroad train pajamas. I hate my railroad train pajamas. It had been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. My mom says some days are just like that, even in Australia." It's a great little children's book that captures a truth that is far more literal and far more devastating and far more important than wearing railroad train pajamas. And that is that there are times in our lives, I would say seasons in our lives, when we would define them as tough stuff. There are lots of things that we bring on ourselves by our poor choices. And then there are things that come into our lives that we had nothing to do with it. It wasn't our choice. We didn't choose it, and we wouldn't choose it. But it is a part of the human experience. And the thing that I find so fascinating about this book that we call our Bible is that it doesn't sugarcoat life. It expresses ways for God to be in the midst of those kinds of things. Not to take us out of it like we didn't deserve it. You know, not to send us to Australia, but rather to walk with us in whatever those patterns are. So for the next 3 or 4 or 5 weeks or so, I'm going to talk about various aspects of the general topic dealing with the tough stuff. Junk happens, guys, and when junk happens, what's really important is that you and I have got a relationship with the Lord and an understanding of His Word enough to have a place to go when the tough stuff happens. And maybe the very place to start is to talk about how to prepare ourselves when we hit that season or that set of circumstances. And to do that, I want you to go to an Old Testament passage, the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2, preparing for how to deal with the tough stuff. In Nehemiah chapter 2, we're jumping in the middle of a story. A few years ago, I taught the book of Nehemiah. I like it very much. And it would be great to spend all that time to give you all the background and all the other stuff, but I can't do that. We're going to jump into a part of the story. I've got to give you a little bit of background, though, or the story doesn't make any sense. In Nehemiah chapter 2, starting in verse number 9, a guy by the name of Nehemiah says, "Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and the horsemen, and when Sanballat and Tobiah heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel." Now a quick bit of background so this makes a little bit of sense. As you know, the children of Israel, when they came into the promised land, there were 12 tribes and the land was allotted to them. Each tribe got a section. Essentially, 10 tribes got part of the territory to the north and 2 tribes got part of the territory to the south. As time went on, they exercised rebellion, much like you and I do. And at various times, God sends prophets along to say, "Clean up your act, judgment's coming." And they blew them off. God used enemies of Israel to bring judgment, to bring focus to them, to their sin. And He used the nation of the nation of Assyria in the first place to come over the top of what was known as the Fertile Crescent and come down on the top of Israel and essentially wiped out the top 10 tribes. The bottom 2 tribes escaped that part of the judgment. About 100 years later or so, another nation rose up and attacked again from the north and down through those 10 tribes, which were dispersed by that time. And here they are being under the attack of the nation of Babylon. And this time, the bottom 2 tribes get wiped out as well. What Babylon did was grab some of the best of them and exile them to their country, to the nation of Babylon. So here we have an exiled nation. For many years, they were in exile. In fact, the book of Jeremiah, and actually in a different place in Isaiah, it's prophesied that they would be exiled for 70 years. And exactly that happens. At the end of the 70 years, it's God's plan that those exiles get to come back to Israel, specifically to the city capital of Jerusalem. They came back in waves, 3 separate waves. The first wave was done by the king Cyrus, and he sent Zerubbabel back. I love that name. There are some names in the Bible I just think are cool, and I like Zerubbabel. If I had children, I'd never name them that, but I just think that's a cool name, Zerubbabel. He sends Zerubbabel back. He sends him back in 538 B.C., and when he comes back, out of 2, maybe 3 million exiles, only about 49,000 of them decided to go back. Cyrus says, "I'll let you go back. You can go back to your nation. You can go back to your capital. You can set up your worship. You can rebuild your temple. You can put your walls back up. I'll even help a little bit. You guys can go back." And out of 2 to 3 million people, only 49,000 and change raised their hand and said, "We'll go back." The rest of them were fat, dumb, and happy in exile. So Zerubbabel comes back, and it's his job to rebuild the temple. He gets at it. They work hard at it. They don't get it quite done. A bunch of delays occur, and finally in 516 B.C., the temple itself is restored. So then a new king comes on the scene in Babylon. Now we're into some Persian kings, and Artaxerxes comes along and says, "You know what, Ezra, you're a cool guy, you're a big leader, you can go back." And he goes back with about 1,000, a little over 1,000 guys. I think your notes say 41,000, but it's 1,754. So in 458 B.C., Ezra comes back, and Ezra's job, he's the spiritual giant. He's the preacher. He's coming back to set up the temple worship, to get them back to tithing, to get them to use the temple, to make Israel and specifically Jerusalem what it used to be. A little bit later, Artaxerxes is going to send back a third wave, and the third wave is led by Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah in the first chapter, hears about what's going on in Israel, and his heart's broken. He wants to go back, but he's scared to death. He ends up praying about it until he's comfortable, and he goes into the king and says, you know, I got to go back. Some bad stuff's happening in Jerusalem. And the amazing thing is that Artaxerxes not only lets him go, but sends him with amazing, we'll call them purchase orders, if you will, so that along the way he could get all the supplies he needed, so when he gets to Jerusalem, he can actually start rebuilding the walls of the city. Now, back then, if you were a city, you had walls around it. Otherwise, you weren't protected. And here sits Jerusalem. They got a new temple. They're starting with some of their worship. Things are going okay, but they can't be protected because they have no wall. Nehemiah raises his hand and says, I'll go back and I'll express some leadership and get the walls rebuilt. That's the context of our story. It's about a 900-mile journey. And they would not have made more than 15 to 20 miles a day. So this is a month and a half to 2 month journey from the part, what you would know is the southern most part of Iraq, up across the Tigris and Euphrates and down all the way to Jerusalem. A long journey. And along that way, he stopped with those king's letters, maybe the purchase orders, and he uses them to get the supplies he's going to need to rebuild the wall. When he arrives into town, in verse 11, he says, I came to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. 3 days. What did he do for 3 days? I don't know. Bible didn't tell us. The thing I want you to see is that he didn't jump into activity the moment he showed up in town. He's the new governor. He's got a badge to prove it. Artaxerxes has sent me. Here's my badge. I'm the new governor in town. I'm the boss. I've got purchase orders to get all the supplies I need. I've got some of the king's army with me to enforce, regardless of who the enemies are, and he gets introduced to them very early in verse 10. He says, regardless of what Sanballat or Tobiah, and really there's lots of other enemies that are listed later in the book, and I put them in your notes. Regardless of those enemies, I'm here. I've got a job to do. But he waited. He waited a little bit. At the end of the 3 days, he says he rose up in the middle of the night, verse 12, I and a few men with me, not the whole crowd, not the whole group, and I did not tell anybody what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the one on which I was riding. He says, so I went out at night, and I went by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well, and I went on to the refuge. Inspected the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. And so I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again, and I returned. And all the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or the rest who did the work. Now, the first thing I want you to see is that when his 3-day rest period is over, and I suspicion because of how he reacted in chapter 1 that he spent 3 days in prayer, even though our Bible doesn't specify that. At the end of the 3 days, he goes out at night and he inspects the walls. He keeps the plans to himself. He physically gets on his horse and rides around. Now, I put a little chart in your notes. It doesn't matter that you don't like charts as much as I do, but here's a chart. The thing I wanted you to know is that the walls around the city in the north would have been completely destroyed during the time of the Assyrians and certainly when the Babylonians laid siege to Jerusalem. So he didn't even bother to go to the north part of the city. He knew those would be completely wiped out. His little trek is all along the southern part. And if you looked up in a good Bible dictionary, the Valley Gate and the Jackal Wall, the Dung Gate and the Fountain Gate, you'd realize that they're all along the bottom part of that wall or of that section of the city where the Hinnom Valley and the Kidron Valley come together from that side to the left, from the east to the west. He's riding around in that section. It's so badly damaged, you can't even get a horse through it. One single horse couldn't go some of the area. When he's finished, he's realized that these walls and the gates of Jerusalem that have been in ruins for 140 or so years, that in spite of some attempts to rebuild them, nothing's happened, and the people are devastated because this bad thing has occurred, but not devastated enough to do anything about it. They're in a tough time of their life. It's a difficult thing. It's a time when they could just walk outside and look and see how bad the situation was, But nobody either had the leadership or the energy or the encouragement or the enthusiasm to do anything about it. And time out a second. Isn't that how it is when you enter in one of those seasons of life? Don't you just grind to a halt sometimes? There's a sense of, I can't accomplish anything. The energy that's necessary just to get up and brush my teeth is more than I can bear. The normal stuff that I would do, the normal life expectancies, it's just more than I can deal with. As I've counseled women that have had serious difficulties with depression, they talk about that it's like somebody just pulls the plug on them, and they just can't do it. That's essentially what's happened here. And here rides into town Nehemiah with on his heart the plan of the Lord to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. A time, a difficult time for the children of Israel. But Nehemiah, from verse 17 to 20, he's going to grab his belt and pull up his breeches and pull his shirt tails together and announce in a loud voice, "Wait a minute, we can do this. We can get this done. We can make it through this season." Look at verse 17. "And then I said to them, 'All right, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire. Come on, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach.' And then I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. And then they said, "Woo, let us arise and build." And so they put their hands to the good work. But Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, they mocked us and they despised us and said, 'What is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' So I answered them and said to them, 'The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build. But you, you're going to have no portion, you're going to have no right, and you're going to have no memorial in Jerusalem.'" This is a cool story, guys. I don't want you to miss the exciting punchline here. And in fact, I want to walk you through what Nehemiah really does say. First off, he states the facts. Yep, we're in a bad situation. When you find yourself in what I call tough stuff at the beginning of this lesson, one of the very first things to do is to say to yourself, what really is? If your husband lost his job and you guys aren't sure where you're going to get your nickel for tomorrow, you ought to tell it like it is. That it's a bad situation. This ain't good. If you run into a serious illness in your life, you know, playing Pollyanna about it ain't going to make it go away. Nehemiah faced the facts. He said, "You know what? We've got a bad situation here." And notice the pronoun we. In fact, he asks them to join him. He said, "Come, let us. Come on, we'll together. Let's acknowledge what it is, but let's do this together." One of Satan's greatest tools, and I can express this from my own personal life today, one of the greatest tools he uses when we're in bad stuff is to try to convince us we're the only one, that we're in it alone. What God does is bring people alongside to say to us over and over again, "You ain't alone. I'm in here with you. Yoo-hoo, more than one in the boat. We're over here rowing too." That's what Nehemiah is doing. He's saying, "Let us, together, let's build this building, or let's build this wall." He states the goal very clearly. He doesn't say, "Let's make it all right." He doesn't say, "Let's get all of Israel back to like it was before we fell." He doesn't say, "Let's make sure all the people worship Yahweh." What he says is very specifically, "Let's build this wall. Here's the problem, wall is broken. Let's fix it, build wall." Very clearly. And he gives him some motivation. What is his motivation? He says, "You know what? We're the laughing stock of the area. When the people around look at Jerusalem and hear us talk about worshiping Yahweh, they're cracking up because we're doing nothing to get the city back to the way it was. We're doing nothing to make sure the temple's functioning. We're not doing the offerings the way we should. We haven't even built the wall around to protect our temple. We're a disgrace." People are going, "They serve Yahweh? Let's change that so there's no reproach." When bad stuff happens and it's known in your sphere of influence, in your family, in the people at your work, in a church community, one of the first things they're doing is they're subconsciously in some cases and consciously in other cases asking themselves this question, "So let's see how the Christians act now." You know, they've been yapping,
about how great God is. Let's watch. Quietly, let's watch. And Nehemiah knew that people had been doing that exact thing. So his motivation to the people is, let's change this. Let's make sure there's no more reproach for the name of Yahweh. He promises some help. I love this. He says at one place, he said, let us arrive. Let me back up. Verse 18. And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable on me, and that the king had given me all these purchase orders and all the resources necessary. He reminds them that they have resources, that there's some promises of help. One of the great things that things like music and fellowship and preaching of God's Word and the teaching of God's Word, somebody on the radio, somebody on TV, in our culture, there's help all around us. Just turn and look. There are so many resources for you and I when we're dealing with tough stuff to deal with it. That's what Nehemiah is saying. And then he wants to make sure that they're not all dumb Pollyannas. He says, you know what? I realize we got opposition. Here's Osanballat, here's Tobiah, here's Geshem, and here's all the other guys. And in fact, if you look up who those people are, they represent little subcultures that were living right around Israel. They represent Moab, and they represent Edom, and they represent the Arabs that had come to move into that land. And if you plug them in geographically, they're just sitting right around Israel, just plunk, 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 plunk. And what he says is, I realize we've got guys around us that think this is a joke. There is clearly opposition to us. He's not Pollyanna. It's going to be okay. Rejoice, I say, rejoice. He's not being silly or stupid. He's looking them in the face and saying, I get it. Those guys hate us. Those guys hate us. Those guys hate us. Those guys hate us. But you know what? We got resources here. The good hand of God is upon me. And he's motivated others to help us as well. And then what I love, being ornery, is he gives a little jab to his enemies at the end. At the very end of this passage, he says, and so I answered, that is, the opposition. He says, I answered them, I said to him, you know what, the God of heaven, he's going to give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, we're going to do this. We're going to rise. We're going to build. But you know what, you guys, no portion, no right, no memorial. Now, in English, that doesn't make much sense. But if you understood their culture, what he was saying was, boys, they're not even going to know you lived here. There's going to be no genealogy that includes you. There's going to be no memorial with your name on it. The people of Jerusalem won't even know Tobiah who? Sanballat whom? I'm not sure which of the English that is. His point was, you guys are dust. You're nothing. We're going to do the work. We're going to rise up. We're going to build. We're going to face the issue. We're going to do it together. We're going to accomplish it. The walls are going to be built. And you guys, you're not even going to be noticed as having lived here ever in history. I like that little dig. So what's the point? I think that the point to this story is that there is great power when you're facing a difficult situation and taking a little bit of a time out to prepare for what the next step is. One of my character traits, one of my flaws is that I'm a quick gun. I am fast to go to guns. My mind works quickly, my emotions respond quickly, and I'm a quick gun. So you face a situation in front of me, I am quick to try to resolve it. You know, I was reading about some of the tests that they give executives when they're recruiting them, and one of them is they sit them at a desk and they put a big pile over here in the inbox and an empty outbox over here, and one of the tests is to see how quickly that executive can go through all those situations and dispatch it. I would be very good at that. Anything to get it done. Check, cross it off, finished. I'm too much that way spiritually, too. I'm too quick to go to guns. I'm too quick to doop, 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 doop. It's supposed to be all finished and all gone. And very often it isn't. And then the frustration in my life is, oh, well, I did this and I did this and I did this and I quoted that and I looked at that and it should be gone. And in fact, it ain't gone. In fact, much of life doesn't go. And this lesson is for people like me that need to take a little bit of time when facing something difficult and allow a moment of preparation, a moment of, let's see, let's consider, let's marshal our resources before we go to guns. Dennis gave me a bumper sticker years ago.
And the bumper said, sticker said, too close for missiles going to guns. Now that's an expression out of, warfare, and he thought it was funny. But I said, Dennis, I can't drive around South County with, too close for missiles, I'm going to guns. But boy, does it express my personality. Nehemiah understood, no, time out, Sherry, whoa. Let's take a moment and see if there isn't some power in preparation. So I've given you, and specifically me, five or six principles that I think in a scenario when you face tough stuff, that you can discover the power of preparation if you pause. So principle number one is exactly that, slow down. Just drop it into neutral. Just kick it back and stop for a moment. Well, you don't understand. Whoa, time. Slow down. Give yourself a moment to think, a moment to pray, a moment to seek counsel, a moment to consider your options, a moment to just consider what's going on, to evaluate what is this stuff? What really is it? How is it affecting me? What should be my response? What might God be doing in this? Where should I be in this whole situation? Instead of quick to guns, slow down. One of the passages that I quote to myself very often is James 1:19. My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to what? Listen. Quick to listen and slow to speak and slow to become angry. Drop it into neutral. Kick it back. Wait a moment. Or as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Whoa! Hold it a second. What's the song of the 60s, Fools Rush In, where angels fear to tread? There is no value when facing difficulty to be the first one in or the first one out. The value is to be the person who is learning and performing and responding according to God's Spirit. And that takes a bit of slowing down, kicking back, waiting. There was a writing, a poem, if you will, an exercise of something called Slow Me Down, Lord, and I've had it at my desk for a long time. It says this, slow me down, Lord. Ease the pounding of my heart by quieting my mind. Steady my hurried pace with a vision of the eternal. Give me, amid the confusion of this day, the calmness of the everlasting hills. Break the tension of my nerves and my muscles with the soothing music of the singing streams that live in my memory. Teach me the art of taking minute vacations, of slowing down to look at flowers and talk to kids and pat dogs and smile and read a good book. Slow me down, Lord. Inspire me to send my roots deep into the soil of life's enduring values that I may grow. Remind me each day that the race is not to the swift, but there is more to life than increasing its pace. And let me look upward to the towering oak and know that it grew great and strong because it grew slowly and well. That is in opposition to how our world normally works, and most of us, not all of you, but many of you are like me. Slow down. He took some time. He evaluated. He didn't go rushing to solve the problem instantaneously. He wanted to make sure, the second principle, that he knew what the problem really was. John Maxwell, a great motivational speaker of our era, he has a little phrase and he says, what you think is the problem isn't the problem. And what he's saying is that often what you are whining about or complaining about is just an external expression. The real problem is somewhere underneath whatever the irritation is that's for you. But the truth of the matter is that is part of our human experience. We are not always clear about really what the problem is. He wanted to go out and ride around for himself. Don't you think he got a report about those walls? I'll bet you they had charts and graphs. I'll bet you surveyors had been out there. I'll bet you they had evaluated exactly what it would take to rebuild it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got the POs so he could stop and get what he needed to build the gates. He knew exactly how many gates there were and how much timber it was going to take. He knew, I'm sure, how many rocks were going to have to be rolled from the quarry over to those walls.
I don't doubt for a second that he didn't have all that in memo form before he ever left the land of Babylon. But for himself, he took the time to evaluate and state what the real problem was. I read a story this week, too. It made me laugh about this. A guy went to the doctor and said, I'm having terrible headaches, and they're intense, and it's awful. And the doctor evaluated for a few minutes, and he said, well, do you smoke? And the guy said, yeah, I do. And he said, well, then that's it. Stop smoking. So the guy stopped smoking. Next week, he went back in. The doc said, how's the headaches? Oh, they are terrible. They're still persisting? Do you drink? Well, yeah, I drink. Stop drinking. So the guy stopped drinking, and the next week he went back to see the doctor, and the doctor said, well, had those headaches gone away? And he goes, no, man, they're terrible. He said, well, are you engaged in some physical labor? What do you do for a living? And he described what he did, and he said, well, that's the problem. You got to stop, get a new job. So he quit that week. Next week he went back, and the doc said, how you doing? All those headaches gone? And he said, no, they're worse. And finally the doctor looked over and stuck his finger in his collar and pulled a little, and then he said to the guy, what size shirt do you wear? Well, I wear a 16, and he flipped back the back of his collar, and he was wearing a size 15. And all this time, he'd been wearing a shirt that was too tight, it was cutting off the blood flow to his head. Had nothing to do with smoking or drinking or where he worked. The problem wasn't any of those things. It was a dumb collar around his neck. And we're a lot like that, too. We get to fussing about something, but maybe the something ain't the real problem. The fact that your husband loses his job is a problem, but that lack of trust and that frustration and that anger that's welling up in you, is it because of the lack of job, or is it because you've not learned to trust God for your needs rather than your husband's job? Sometimes what we think is the problem ain't really the problem. And I'm saying principle number two that Nehemiah's teaching us is be clear about what the problem is. A biblical story or illustration of this is in Numbers 13 and 14. They send the spies out. When they were first coming into the land, the spies come back. They carry grapes that are yo big on their shoulders. 10 of them go, yeah, great, land of milk and honey, terrific, but the people, they're giants. And 2 of them, Joshua and Caleb, said, yeah, they're giants, but man, we can take them. God's promised. And what did the children of Israel do? They didn't listen to the 2. They listened to the other 10. The other 10 convinced them that the problem was the giants. That wasn't the problem. The problem was their lack of faith. So you and I need to be clear about what our problem is. Sometimes you need to get alone and really evaluate what is it that you're kicking against. What exactly is going on? Not necessarily the externals, but what's happening inside of you that's making this a tough season. And be clear about what the problem is. Because you can't bring to bear resources if you don't know what the real problem is. Principle number 3 is consider what resources you do have. There is a great story in 2 Chronicles, and I want you to turn there. In 2 Chronicles chapter 32, the leader in Israel at that time is a guy by the name of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Chronicles 32. The bad guy in this story is a man by the name of Sennacherib, and he's the king of Assyria. He is bearing down on those 10 tribes to the north and is ready to wipe out that portion of Israel. Hezekiah realizes things are not really good in verse number 20, but Hezekiah and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, prayed about this impending doom and cried out to heaven. And here's what the Lord did for them. He sent an angel who destroyed every mighty warrior, commander, and officer in the camp of the Assyrians. And so he returned in shame to his own land. And when he had entered the temple of his God, some of his own children killed him there with the sword. Sennacherib didn't have a good ending to the story. So the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all others, and guided them on every side. And many were bringing gifts to the Lord at Jerusalem, choice presents to Hezekiah, so that he was exalted in the sight of all nations thereafter. God brought to bear some incredible resources during the great battle that Hezekiah was leading. He thought he was going to get wiped up, and in fact, not so. Every warrior for the other enemy got wiped out. When Sennacherib went back in shame to Assyria, his own kids killed him off, and Hezekiah is brought to the forefront with great blessings from the Lord. The resources that God has available to meet our individual needs are enormous. And often they're not even ones we would think of. But He has them for us. The resources that are available for the believer is unbelievable. Look at Romans chapter 8, verse 31. At the end of a great discussion in that chapter, if there was only one chapter in your whole Bible, I'd want Ephesians 1 and Romans 8. Those are the two chapters that I would want if I could only have two. But in Romans 8, verse 31, he says, what shall we say to these things? This famine and pestilence and everything that was just before it. If God is for us, who can be against us? But you don't understand, Sherry, we just lost our house. My response to you is, you're right, I don't understand, I haven't lost my house. But Romans 8:31 is still in our Bible. If God is for us, who can be against us? You don't understand, X and Y and Z was just diagnosed for us. You're right, I don't have that disease, but I still have Romans 8, and so do you. If God is for you, who can be against you? You don't understand, for 10 years we've struggled with da-da-da in our marriage. You're right, I don't understand, I'm not married, I haven't struggled for 10 years, but Romans 8:31 is still in the book. The resources that are there and available for you and I are unbelievable. Hebrews 13:6, so that we may boldly say, here's our conclusion, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is my helper, I will not fear. God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and a sound mind. 2 Timothy 1:7. This is the response to our evaluating our resources. Nehemiah knew exactly what he had to work with. And when he got to the end of this time, he's reminding them. He's also reminding them that there are resources from other places, not just from the Lord. And I listed two situations. One is the mighty men of David, which you ought to go look and study in 2 Samuel 23. But there's a great little story about Moses and Aaron in Exodus 17. In fact, turn there. Exodus chapter 17. You can find that one because it's right at the front of your Bible. Exodus 17. In Exodus chapter 17, there's a fight going on between Israel and a group called Amalek. And Amalek's come up and fighting against them. And so Moses says to Joshua in verse 9, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I'm going to station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and a guy by the name of Hur, went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up, he's got the staff in his hand, that Israel prevailed. But when he got tired and his arm couldn't hold it up there anymore, and his arm started to come down, then Amalek would prevail. And don't you think that God realized we needed some help? We needed some resources? So he hollers at Aaron and Hur and says, hey, help him out. And the two of the guys come running over, and on one on each side, hold up Moses' arm. He's got the staff out. Now the staff is up. Israel prevails. They win. The Amaleks lose. Why? Because God brought resources to bear. In the personhood of two people, isn't that what he usually does for us? When you have tough stuff going on in your life, isn't very often the resources that are brought to bear people? Sure it is. Somebody that can come alongside and hold you up. Maybe not literally like they were holding Moses up, but certainly spiritually and emotionally and psychologically, and maybe even physically. Somebody walked by me today in the office and said, Sherry, I have this little thing called an M2032 I think it's Mark 2032, where Jesus says, what can I do for you? And it's a way for me to just say to the staff, how can I be a blessing to you? What do you need? So I sent out some M32s yesterday, and just to see if I could be an encouragement to anybody on staff. And this lady walked by me and she said, you know, you're always sending us M32s. I'm going to send you an M32. What do you need? Can I go to the store for you? Can I pick up your dry cleaning? Those are valuable things when life is tough. Somebody needs to hold you up. Maybe if you're not in one of those seasons, you ought to be looking around to find somebody who is. Go find a Moses who needs a little help. And if you're in one of those systems or seasons, what you need to remember is that God not only provides himself his resources, but he sends others as well. One of the great verses in Ecclesiastes, again chapter 4, says, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who, when he falls, is by himself. There's nobody to pick him up.
All those folks in the world out there that are suffering, that's the cry of their heart. There's nobody for them. That's why the church is so valuable. It's not meant to be a social club. It's meant to be a spiritual retreat, a place where somebody will pay attention. And when you need help, they rally it. One of the challenges right now with Rose is there are so many people who want to rally and want to help that they're falling over each other and getting in the way of the kids spending time with their mom. What a good problem to have. It needs to be fixed, but it's still a good problem to have. Resources that God brings to bear. Principle number four is better be ready and prepared for some opposition. Remember, chapter 2 and verse 8 of Nehemiah, the passage we started with, he says in verse 18, and I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me. The hand of my God was on me. The good hand of God, even in verse 8 of this chapter, when he's describing that he's going to leave the king, he says, the king granted all these requests to me because, quote, the good hand of my God was upon me. And the thing I wanted to remind you of is what Nehemiah recognized when he was doing his work, is that the good hand of God sometimes includes opposition. We have the mistaken idea because we want God to be like us. It's called the anthropomorphic syndrome. We want God to respond like us. We want him to act like we would act as people. If you had a need, I would respond. Well, I wouldn't respond all the time, and I would probably only respond as far as, you know, it was good for, yeah, but God's not like that. God doesn't deal like men. God deals like God, and he's sovereign. And in his sovereignty, sometimes his good hand includes stuff we would not have chosen. I've joked with you before about things like, you know, flat tires. When we get a flat tire, the first thing we say is, why today? And I ask you with a little sarcasm in my voice, when's a good day for a flat tire? Has anybody ever taken their palm, looked forward in the next 6 months and said, Tuesday the 27th, good day for a flat tire? I'm penciling that in. No. When's a good day for you, you know, your pipes to break and you to have a problem at the house? When is a good day for that? Has anybody ever written that into their calendar? No. When's a good day for the kids to get sick? You're not writing that down. When's a good day for dad to lose his job? You're not going to put that in your calendar. But sometimes the good hand of God includes opposition. That's part of God's sovereign plan because he knows best. Stuff we would never choose are put into our path so that we can live through and with them to the glory of God and for our own growth and development. So the good hand of God sometimes includes opposition. The good hand of God. Ruth, in the book of Ruth, in chapter 1, verse number 13, she's describing herself, and she said, don't you call me Ruth, you call me Myra. And the reason you call me Myra is because my life is bitter. And why is it bitter? Because my husband and my two sons, they've all died. I have no resources. I have no heritage. I'm going home to die. She looked at what had happened from God's hand as not good. But ultimately, if you read the four chapters of Ruth, God restores her in some significant ways never would have happened if the opposition had not been a part of that plan. We don't choose opposition, but in the good hand of God, sometimes it's there. And recognize that will make you a much happier person. Fighting against that as if nothing bad should ever happen to us will just drive you crazy. God's sovereign will includes opposition on occasion. And principle number five, he declares it at the end of the passage we read, you know, let's arise and build. Let's get on with it. Let's see what we got to do and let's get it done. In fact, if you look forward a couple, three chapters in Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 15, you realize that in 52 days, they rebuilt the wall. In 52 days, with no modern equipment, 52 days, a bunch of ragtag guys got together and rebuilt the wall, rebuilt all those gates. In fact, if you look at the listing over in chapter 3, the builders of the wall, I love this list. This is a lesson in and of itself. They got guys that are perfumers working.
What do guys who crush flowers for a living know about building walls? There's a bunch of girls that get involved in this building of the wall. What do a bunch of girls know about moving brick and building gates? We're not talking about little gates like door jams. We're talking about door jams, gate jams that chariots can run through. Walls so thick you could run chariots on top. How do they get it done in 52 days? They get it done in 52 days because our passage says, or rather chapter 4 verse 6 says, so they built the wall, the entire wall was joined together up to half its height. How, why, and what circumstance? Because the people had a mind to work. They had an attitude change. They said, let us arise and build. Let's get it done. Let's trust God for the resources. Let's look to each other for support. And let's get it done. I don't know what's going on in your life. I don't know the circumstances or challenges that you may be facing now. Or maybe, you know, that season's just around the corner. But the solution to it, the answer to it, the principle that you want to settle on is that let's rise and build. Let's get it done. Don't stop just because it's difficult. Don't stop just because it hurts. Don't quit just because it's not fun. See, that's the world's idea. If it isn't fun, if it isn't, you know, great, if we're not thoroughly enjoying ourselves, we're not going to do it. That is not God's plan. They arose and built. 52 days, walls done, they're finished. Nehemiah has accomplished his task because he gave them something to work for. That was accomplishing what God had sent him to do. What God has given you for your life, your family, your situation, your circumstances, that is his plan. Now rise up and build. Get it done. I read a story about 1952, a gal by the name of Florence Chadwick. She was a woman who had swam the English Channel, and she came here to California to swim from here to Catalina. She went out one morning, and it was a very difficult time frame, but it was the time that she was supposed to do it. She dove in the water. She had her friends and family in a little boat with her back in 1952. They didn't have all the stuff we have today. And she took off swimming. The water was exceptionally cold, and there was a terrible set of fog that day, and there were sharks everywhere. And as she was trying to swim those 26 miles, they kept having to shoo the sharks away, and because of that, she'd be off course, and then they'd have to bring her back. And it was awful. Hour after hour went on. She kept trying. Her friends were screaming and hollering. Her family was saying, it's only 26 miles. Hour after hour went by, and finally she couldn't take it anymore. She made the boat come over, and she jumped in the boat. She quit. As she got in the boat, her family made her warm. They sat there for a little while, and as the story goes, about then the fog lifted. And when the fog lifted, they realized they were less than a half a mile from the shore. A half a mile. And the reason she didn't make it is because she couldn't see the shoreline. If she'd been able to see where she was going, she would have made it. And guys, I want to tell you, you and I don't have to worry about fog. Open your Bible to the last two chapters of the book of Revelation and get a picture of where we're going. It's so much different. It's so much better. It's nothing like now. And if we have that clearly in our mind, we won't quit half a mile from the shore. We'll rise up and we'll build. And we'll get through the stuff, the tough stuff. Let's pray together. Lord, thank you so much for this lesson for me. This is really important for me to remember that when facing difficult stuff, taking some time to prepare is smart. Taking some time to recognize our resources, to state the problem so clearly that we can't miss it, to find out where our opportunities really lie, to take a stock of the opposition, and then to realize what we're really working for. This world is not my home. I am just passing through. And my treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. And angels beckon me with heaven's open door. And I cannot, I dare not feel at home in this world anymore. Lord, give us a sense to see the finish line so that we can work through with the good hand of God on us whatever the tough stuff is today. And we pray all this in Christ's name. Amen. Well, thank you for coming. It would have been no fun without you.